call the Senate Tax Committee to order. First bill we have up, Senate File 3643, Senator Torres Ray. Senator Torres Ray, welcome to the Senate Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. This is my first time in front of your committee, so thank you for the opportunity to present this important piece of legislation and something that is very dear to me and to many, many neighbors in my district and outside of my district. I am here to present Senate File 3643, and this particular proposal, Mr. Chair and members, it intends to extend the city of Minneapolis's tax increment finance districts that were not decertified before July 1st of 2008. It intends to extend this certification through December 2019. And the qualifying TIF districts were certified before August 1979, and probably many of you are familiar with this. The additional increments from the extension will be divided between the city's general fund and the neighborhood revitalization program, which we know as NRP. The policy board of the neighborhood revitalization program must remain in place for the duration of the additional funding, is what is in front of you. And I have several people who wish to testify and respond to questions from committee members. But before I call them, I would like to share with you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that this has been really one of the most important projects, in my view, in the city in terms of TIF projects. The legislature authorized this, the establishment of NRP, first in 1990. And since then, we know that we have provided funding for 41 neighborhood organizations that are still in existence today. This is a very special project and different from other projects in the sense that the investment goes directly into the community and the neighborhoods. These organizations cover approximately 63% of the city's population. So there is a lot of people that are involved in this. And NRP has formed and organized 31 additional neighborhood groups and since then, and 100% of the city's population is now covered. Today, more than 1,000 residents serve in the boards of these neighborhood associations. And these, all of these individuals are volunteers. They do not get paid for the work that they do. And they volunteer for thousands and thousands of hours in these particular neighborhood associations involved in different projects that support seniors, young children, families, and many other projects. We have been trying to calculate how many hours residents, neighbors, volunteers have invested in this project. And so far, we think that only for those hours that can be counted as formal hours of committee involvement and very few hours of that we really could count volunteers spending time with residents is about 100,000 hours of time helping improving neighborhoods and related activities to improve community life in all of the neighborhoods where we have these organizations. NRP has invested $274 million in neighborhood projects, programs, services, and activities. And these investments have been made in nine major areas. These areas are housing. 53% of this funding has gone to improve housing. And I would like to tell you a story about my block. In my block, we had houses that were built about 80 years ago, most of the houses in my block. These houses were not in good shape when I moved to the district about 16 years ago. At that time, some NRP funding became available in Many of my neighbors apply for low-interest loans that were very small, and their intent was that they were going to replace windows or do minor projects. Well, with those $3,000 or $4,000 that they were able to get from NRP, many people build additional rooms, fix roofs, expanded houses in significant ways. I bought my house in about $80,000 at that time. My house now is worth over $300,000. And the value of my house is still the same, even with all of the housing problems we have. I attribute that, and many of us attribute that, to the investments that were made through NRP, that although they were small, they really motivated a large number of neighbors to really invest in their house. This funding really became an incentive for many, many of us to really invest in our houses and take care of our homes, and NRP is really responsible for that. 13% of the funding goes to economic development, 7% to parks and recreation, 5% to school and libraries, 5% to crime prevention safety, 4% to community building, 3% to environment, and 2% to transportation and infrastructure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would love to tell you more about NRP and my experiences with participating in multiple projects along the river, schools, with senior housing, homes, and much more. But I would like to invite some members that represent the neighborhood associations, and there are also members of staff from the city and a city council member who wish to testify. So I am going to call first Mr. Doug Walter. Mr. George Gelatis, if you could please come and introduce yourself.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Torres-Ray, maybe your testifiers or you would want to give us a little background on the funding. I mean, you obviously had funding when this program was started and has been ongoing. Has there been a change that in the funding stream that now would necessitate this TIF money, or what's the kind of the background of the funding and what's driving this change at this point?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, Mr. Gelatis will cover all of that and will be available to respond to questions. So
Thank you.
Will be the portion that he will speak to.
Mr. Gelatis, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is George Gelatis. I am a neighbor, one of those thousands of neighborhood volunteers that Senator Torres-Ray was speaking of. I've been involved in my neighborhood organization in the southeastern quadrant of Minneapolis. It's referred to as the Nokomis East Neighborhood Association for something over 10 years, and I'm currently the board chair. I wanted to address three questions, but before I do that, I'll start in responding to the senator's question about why we're talking about TIF funding at this point. NRP was funded through a tax increment funding district, and it was set up by the legislature in 1989. And the particular TIF districts, the revenue from particular TIF districts was set aside for something called the Common Project in Minneapolis, with the anticipation that the funding would be about $20 million per year for 20 years. That funding source stops in 2009, and I'm going to get back to that's a big part of the reason that we're here today. And there are some other issues about the way that funding source has been reduced due to changes in the tax law. But basically, our interest is in continuing the program with its current funding source, which is the TIF district, until or unless we can secure some other long-term source that meets what we believe are the needs of the program. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. So to get back to the remarks that I had prepared to make, I'd like to address three questions. First of all, why we're proposing a TIF extension. So I've already talked about part of that. Why it's important to continue NRP funding, and why we need to do it right now. What's the urgency? So for the first point, we want to extend the TIF districts in order to continue what has been and what we believe should be in the future, a secure long-term source of funding that is not subject to annual budgetary cycles and that is relatively insulated from large-scale politics. And I'll get back to that in a minute. And the other thing is we want to avoid an interruption of that funding source. So we're proposing that we do it by extending the TIF districts because we believe that that is the least disruptive way to continue the funding of NRP. It's both least disruptive to the program itself, but also to all of the involved taxing districts. The proposal that you see set forth in the bill has no impact on Hennepin County or the Minneapolis school budgets because it basically leaves them with the money that they would have received if the districts were decertified. It has negligible impact on the city of Minneapolis for reasons which I will let Doug Walter explain. It's fairly complicated. And it does have a very small impact on LGA distribution and on fiscal disparities, but it does not reduce the pool. It avoids a slight increase in the size of those pools. And again, Doug will address those things. We think it's important to continue NRP funding because it's been a very successful program that has yielded great benefits to the city of Minneapolis and directly and indirectly to the entire metropolitan area and the state. It's provided a significant return on investment by investing in small-scale projects that are augmented by a huge amount of volunteer activity, unpaid, and leveraging of other sources of funding that have been attracted and involved because of the availability of neighborhood-controlled funding. We think it's important to point out that the NRP work does not replace or compete with the city or the county. It complements them because the city, the county, and the state deal with large-scale projects and it does those things efficiently and well, and they're extremely important to all of us in the neighborhoods, and we want to continue cooperating with those other governmental bodies. But what they are not able to do is to provide small-scale, highly local identification of needs and management of projects, and that's what NRP does. And it has allowed us to build a sense of community at a small scale. And I should explain that the typical neighborhood in Minneapolis has about 3,000 to 3,500 citizens. And when you think about that, it's comparable to the size of a lot of small cities, small towns in Minneapolis. And so it's much easier to build a sense of community at that level than at the level of the city of 300,000 people. And while we all consider ourselves residents of the city and we're very proud of that, we also take pride in the fact that we're residents in a neighborhood and we have some local identity. Debbie Evans is going to talk a good deal more about the benefits. Now, the last point I wanted to touch on is the urgency. Why are we coming to you now? Why are we asking you to do this year? The main reason is that NRP has, over the last 18 years, invested a lot of money in building what we refer to as neighborhood capacity. That is to say, building up the organization, building trust, training people in processes, and giving them the sense that they can identify needs, follow process, plan, and execute projects. And we've got a lot of volunteers who have been trained in this stuff, and if we lose funding, the neighborhood organizations are going to lose momentum, projects will lose funding, and we will be unable to continue this activity. And if we do get funding like in a year or 2 years, we're going to have to pick up and reconstruct and rebuild confidence and rebuild trust. And this will be more difficult and more expensive than it would be to just continue it. So those are basically the points that I wanted to make. And I hope that you'll take them into consideration as you evaluate this legislation.
Mr. Jatalis, how much increment are we talking about going to the NRP program? How much money a year are we talking about?
$10 million.
$10 million a year.
That's our best estimate based on the information we've been able to get. And as I said, Doug Walter will talk a good deal more about the amounts of money and the proportions and where it comes from.
Mr. Chair.
Very good. Senator Scoin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gelatis, and so what I'm hearing you say then is if the increment was to expire and the money would just flow onto the levy, you wouldn't be able to convince the city of the importance of the project, that they would continue funding? Is that kind of what this revolves down to?
There is currently no structure within the city to do this, and if it were done through the city, we're concerned about subjecting it to, putting it in competition with police and fire and public works and other city services. And it's, as I said at the beginning, the projects that we do are small scale, locally defined. They're not the kind of thing that is easy to attract the attention of the city, and they're really kind of complicated for the city to deal with. And so we think if it were put under the city, there is a significant risk that these small-scale programs would disappear in favor of larger-scale programs.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, I would like to call Mr. Doug Walter.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Doug Walter. I am a staffer with the Nokomis East neighborhood in Minneapolis and a longtime resident. I put together the chart I believe all of you have. I would like to point out up front that this information is for illustrative uses, as it says on the bottom. We have not been able to obtain the exact figures from the city at this point, but
Mr. Walter, I don't think the committee has the chart, so maybe you could give a copy to us, and we'll get some copies made.
Rita, we have extra copies available. We are looking at a $50 million revenue example chart. The point of this was to illustrate the difference between not extending the tax increment districts and extending as far as this particular Senate file is concerned. Really, it's a summary of what extending the district to the city of Minneapolis in a neighborhood program, what it would do for them. What we did was we took the city budget, we took the numbers that we could find, and a set of projections that ranged between $40 and $50 million in revenue from 15 of the 42 pre-1979 tax increment districts in Minneapolis. It's about 51% of their revenue. We looked at the shares that would be in there, and this particular proposal was done to illustrate the difference between not extending and extending. We know that the numbers in here will vary slightly, but the proportions of the chart should stay the same. For instance, this one is $50 million. $40 million has exactly the same proportions, just different numbers in there, and I can give those to you if you'd like. Last year was approximately a $46 million revenue, so we took the high end of this. What we want to show, what's important, is the difference in the LGA loss at roughly 20%, and our best guess at the fiscal disparity loss, or change to the city at 2%, would make a 24% net change in Minneapolis's part of that 50% of the tax district revenue. That's roughly what the NRP project would cost the city. And rather than look at it as a cap, we look at it as a yearly for the 10 years. And we're saying that NRP, our figures would be about, in this example, $12.5 million versus the city's $13 million, and that $500,000 would be the difference, what the cost to the city would be to have NRP. The offset on that is that the city then gains $12.5 million. to use in their general fund at their discretion. I believe that they're discussing the target center debt relief. There isn't a whole lot more I can say on this. I would be happy to answer questions on how we got to this point. We should mention that, before we go on to this, mention that we are looking at a $110 million shortfall because of those tax revenue changes in 2001, or the 3-2 change to commercial properties in 2001. The purpose of this is to try and recapture that original commitment from the legislature, $395 million, and the cities had moved that up to $400 million to finish that off and complete that. We have made every part of our commitment has been kept. By extending this, we are looking at finishing the state and the city's commitment to the NRP program.
Mr. Walter, I mean, the way your chart looks to me is if we extend the TIF, the city of Minneapolis is, you know, pretty close to kept whole. Instead of $13 million, they get $12.5 million. But it really looks like what we'd be doing is shifting $10 million of LGA, which is state money, and $2 million, which is fiscal disparities, which is money from all the other communities in the metropolitan area, over to the NRP program. I mean, that's what it looks like.
Mr. Chair, I don't look at it that way. I'm not an expert in LGA, certainly not an expert in the metro fiscal disparity pool. But that LGA lost to the city, money paid back to the city would not be, in this particular instance, have anything to do with NRP.
But Mr. Walter, there's not, I mean, if the TIFs decertify, Minneapolis actually has $500,000 more money, even with the LGA loss, than they do with the extension.
So I
don't see where it makes a whole lot of difference either way to the city of Minneapolis, the proposal's crafted.
Mr. Chair, it does not. That is the point that we're trying to make with this chart, that it doesn't make a difference to the city, except that by decertifying, not taking any action on this, NRP would receive $0. There would be no money left for NRP the way this structure is currently set.
Mr. Walter, did the NRP program approach the city about just levying for the $10 million that NRP 10 or 12, whatever the number NRP would like to have to fund their program?
Mr. Chair, I can't answer that question. I could refer it to Bob Miller, who's director of the Neighborhood Revitalization Program.
Oh, if he could be prepared to answer that when he comes up, that'd be fine. Any other questions for Mr. Walter? Thank you, Mr. Tallis and Mr. Walter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members, I would like to call Mr. Bob Miller to respond to your question, Mr. Chairman, and to give an overview of the NRP program. And the city is also here, Mr. Chairman and members, to respond to some of the questions you may have with respect to the city's approach to this, and that we have been in communication about this. Unfortunately, the city, our process kind of moved faster than the city's process, and they were able to pass a resolution to support this last night. And so I just became aware of it last night, and council member is here to testify to provide that support today.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Miller. I'm the director of the Neighborhood Revitalization Program, and I appreciate the opportunity to come here today to talk to you. The question is about whether or not we've approached the city about doing a levy. Frankly, that is only one of many different options that have been explored over the years. In fact, back in 2005 and 2006, we had a multi-jurisdictional task force that came up with a whole range of options that could be explored, and that report was provided to the City Council in April of 2006. So this has been in the works for a long time. The particular approach that's being suggested here is one that provides probably the greatest level of stability and certainty to the neighborhoods, as opposed to one which is subject to an annual variance or to some of the different changes that can occur with financial activities like this. If you look at NRP, probably the biggest thing about it has been that it has reinvested back into the communities. Now, I've got some experience with this stuff only because of the fact I've been in government for 40 years, and there are very few programs, very few, that I have ever seen that have had the impact that this one has had. And I don't say that because I'm the director of the program. I say that because of the fact of all of the changes that have occurred because of it. What it has done is it has focused a lot of creativity and imagination from residents and from jurisdictions on doing things differently and doing them in ways that are more holistic, that are more designed to approach real problems that people have to deal with on a daily basis. The investments that NRP has made over the years are in all the areas that Senator Torres Ray was identifying, and those are interesting. Those are areas that are of concern to residents in some pretty basic manners. So it's what happens to the quality of life that they're subject to. These investments had basically been ignored in many cases by the city, by other jurisdictions, until the residents came forward and said, we've got to pay some attention to it. What NRP provided was the resources that allowed them a seat at the table and gave them an opportunity to actually influence outcomes. Very few projects that NRP has done over the years or that neighborhoods have been a part of have been solely the result of an NRP investment. The NRP investments are used as leverage. They are used to get other people to the table and to accomplish those tasks that otherwise would be impossible. I think if you look at this from the standpoint of the dollars, Senator Bach, you're absolutely right. You look at this and say, okay, there's very little difference between the two. What you did in 1990 was you set up the opportunity for residents to have more control over a small portion of dollars. But these dollars amount to less than 0.7% of the city's annual budget. So for most programs, they're pretty insignificant. But remember that back in 1990, when NRP started, the only real funding source that neighborhoods had was the community development block grants and small foundations or small amounts from foundations if they could qualify for the projects that they had there. They had no ability to do the kind of projects that NRP has been able to help them to accomplish. That's part of the reason why so many people have come forward and who have been participants in this program over the years. When you set up this program and when you initiated the legislation, you looked at three or four different objectives. You wanted to have every neighborhood in the city have an opportunity to participate, regardless of their economic or social conditions. You wanted to have 52.5% of that investment in housing and in improvements to the housing stock. You put that into the statute. You wanted residents to be involved, and you wanted long-term plans. And those are the requirements you built into the statute. What have the neighborhoods actually delivered? Well, every single neighbor in the city of Minneapolis participates in this program. They all have independent boards. They have residents who meet with them on a regular basis. We have thousands of people in the city who are involved in their community. We have met the 52.5% requirement for the housing commitment. And we have long-term plans. We've gone through one iteration where every single neighborhood has developed a long-term plan. Now 40 out of the 72 neighborhoods have phase two plans. That's where we've come. So we feel that the neighborhoods have done exactly what you asked them to do, and what's being asked here is to continue and finally meet the remaining part of the commitment, which is the balance of the $400
million. Mr. Miller, I got to tell you, I'm struggling with why paying for the cost of this program should be shifted to the state and to the property taxpayers, the commercial property taxpayers outside of Minneapolis, in the metro area.
Senator Bach, I understand that and the issue here is the city will end up, if these districts are decertified, the city will end up having lost some of the local government aid that would have come from the state anyway. it will end up losing the portion of the fiscal disparities dollars that would go back to the seven metropolitan counties. Eventually, the state and the counties will bear the cost for the long-term impacts of that change. If these neighborhoods go down and these foreclosures, and that's just one part of this, if all of these other changes continue and these neighborhoods go down, which is why you initiated this program back in 1989, the state and the county and the schools and the libraries and the parks are all going to pick up the responsibility for dealing with it, as you will too. And you will see it in the loss of tax base. You will see it in the loss of stability in the neighborhoods. You will see it in increased social costs and public safety costs and anything else that you want to look at. You recognized that back in 1989. It hasn't changed. So these investments, this does require you to take a bigger perspective than just looking at where these finances come from at this point in time. You've got to look at what the long-term impacts of this change are. If we disinvest in these neighborhoods, we will pay for it in the future, and it will cost a lot more to fix the problems at that point than it is to invest now in smaller chunks and do something about these issues before they become real crises. So the costs will be the states, and they will be the other localities, too, eventually.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Moore.
Mr. Miller, what happens in on January 1 of 2020 when the extension, if you were successful today, decertifies? Has there been some thought given to the continuity of the funding of the neighborhood project?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore, absolutely. In fact, one of the things that we've been able to do with neighborhoods over the years is to build their capacity, as George was saying, to the point where neighborhoods have looked at how can we use the revenues we're getting not just to improve our neighborhoods but to build on our capacity and build in some sufficiency for ourselves in the future. But if you take a neighborhood that starts from a budget of $500, well, you can't really build up any continuance of that until you've got enough capital that they've realized so that they can actually continue to operate and to invest additional dollars into their organization. Revolving loans return income to the neighborhoods. That income is reinvested back in the neighborhood. A portion of it can be used for other things that don't generate income, though. Now, you cannot do that if you basically limit the program to 1 or 2 or 5 years. You can only build up that income stream over a period of time. As any of you who have a business understand, you don't start a business figuring you're going to make $5 million the first year. You can get to that point, but you can't start there. And that's what, in effect, we're trying to do with our neighborhoods. But we need the time that was originally envisioned and the investment that was originally invested in order to accomplish that. Had we had the dollars that were initially expected, and had they come to the neighborhoods in 1999 through 2009 the way they were supposed to, I think we could have accomplished that by this point in time. I do not think we can do it at the point in time right now. We still have a long ways to go.
Senator, Mr. Chair, and Senator Mua, and members, Mr. Chairman, you asked the question as to why others should pay for a program that is for the city. And this is precisely the reason I decided to take on this project and come and ask for your support. The reason is that with a very small investment, state investment, we can make a tremendous difference in the city, in the largest city of this state. And as we move forward in trying to support policies that will really strengthen your district, my district, all the cities in the state of Minnesota, I am here just to let you know that this is a very important project and that with a very, very small investment, state investment, the city has been able to really generate hundreds of millions of dollars that came from residents, from volunteers, from organizations, from foundations that have really helped the city move in a different direction. I give you an example of what happened in my block, but I can give you so many examples of schools that have built playgrounds, parks that have been rebuilt by volunteers that really would have cost the city a lot of money. And I will venture to say that it would have cost the state a lot of money if we had to really work with park boards and other organizations that receive state dollars to do some of those repairs. In the future, what I am hoping that I can do, Mr. Chair, is that come to you and show you more and more the progress that we're making through these projects, especially now that these neighborhood organizations are really prepared now, after all of these years, to do more work and become really more self-sufficient. They have applied for funding from, you know, multiple sources and doing significant projects. I am afraid, Mr. Chair, members, that we're going to lose a lot of that if we don't protect the existing governance and the existing projects, that we're not going to be able to have all of these volunteers so excited about these little projects that they see as, you know, kind of their babies. They own these projects. They are there because they want to see that succeed. I'm afraid that if they are no longer in charge of making those projects succeed, they're going to go away, and we are going to really lose a tremendous asset in the city of Minneapolis and in the state of Minnesota.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know what kind of time we have, not today, but at a future date, but it is hard to simply articulate how important NRP has been to the vitality and success of Minneapolis and its livability. And it's not just, you know, it's big efforts that have made a tremendous difference, you know, in the vitality, the marketability, you know, and on and on. I think Mr. Miller and Senator Torres-Rae have done a nice job articulating that. It'd be even better to have some visual representations and some way to really show the committee how important it is. I completely understand your question about, you know, if it's so great, why doesn't Minneapolis put forward the effort itself, and why are we, you know, offsetting this with LGA? And that's a fair question. I think the argument has been made at the table. But I do actually wonder, and I don't know the methodology, and I don't know if we have time to delve into it. This LGA loss, if the districts were decertified, combined with the fiscal disparity loss, seems a little high to me. And so at some point after this, I think maybe we can get together with our analysts and find out if, I mean, because it looks like a dollar-for-dollar replacement out of LGA for, you know, the NRP program for the next 10 years. And, mm-hmm. you know, it seems like, you know, given that we're talking about $50 million flowing into the city's general fund, if they were, or all the district's general fund, the $12 million, it just seems a little high to me. So
apparently, Senator Dibble, there's a lot of tax capacity coming online.
Very much so.
So, well, I'd still be interested in the analysis and the methodology.
And when the city comes up, maybe they can tell us how much. I noticed this was apparently put together by the city. It says source on the bottom. So maybe we can ask them.
Right.
To be clear, we used Mr. Chair, we used figures from the city budget, and it was not prepared by the city. We prepared it, and we tried to present it as a worst case in terms of the LGA and the fiscal disparities. We did try to present kind of a worst case situation, and the funding that we're referred to is funding that is currently going to the city of Minneapolis, and so it is not. It is not a reduction in the LGA pool directly. It's avoiding an increase in the LGA pool that would be distributed to the rest of the city. But you are quite right. It's a transfer of costs, and we do understand that. But we think that I think as Senator Dibble has pointed out, the vitality of the city of Minneapolis is critical not just to the city, but to the entire state, and that's why we think it's worthwhile.
Well,
it's probably just important to state that LGA is a function of a level of appropriation that we decide on, so there are no automatic increases to the LGA pool, and I think that's what the folks at this table are focused on and concerned about. So there are no automatic, unless we index, which, I'm for that too.
So, Senator Dibble, we're going to try.
Mr. Chairman and members, I have an in-depth review of the NRP neighborhood investment in here. We didn't make copies for all of you, but if I'm going to pass it around and just let. We do. Okay, thanks.
Senator Torres-Ray, we have to get to your next witnesses.
Yes.
We've got several other bills and sessions earlier today.
Senator Torres-Ray, just maybe a quick question. Give me a framework, not being as familiar perhaps. Is the NRP a citywide program, or is it dedicated to a specific neighborhood or section of the city? Basically, does the program apply to the whole city? Is that what the increment district is, or is it another district?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Senjum, it is a citywide project.
Okay.
It is clear that, some particular areas are doing very significant work while others are not. And I think that's part of the progress that we see right now is that some areas, some neighborhood associations are really expanding and doing tremendous work through support of foundations and others. But it is a citywide project.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator,
if I could just help round out that answer a little bit, Senator Senjum. The income for NRP is derived from specific downtown districts, tax increment financing districts, that had like excess, the value increased because the development boom of that time lent itself to being able to distribute some of those resources citywide in fashion. It is a citywide; every neighborhood participates. Some neighborhoods have different and more intensive needs than other neighborhoods, and that's also recognized within NRP. Some had very intensive capital type needs, for example, around housing, and some of the core neighborhoods, Phillips, near North, those sorts of things. Some of the more far flung down at my end of town, for example, had less intensive needs, but needs nonetheless around public safety or parks or libraries or public works, those sorts of things. And so the level that a neighborhood had to a level of resources a neighborhood had to work with was scaled according to those differences.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, I believe the City Council member Betsy Hodges is here, and she wishes to testify, and I believe she has some other staff members that will be
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Betsy Hodges. I am on the Minneapolis City Council, and I am chair of our Intergovernmental Relations Committee. I also participated in the city's NRP working group, along with three other council members, a representative from the mayor's office, and Mr. Miller, executive director. I'm joined today by Jack Crist, who is from the city's finance department, who I think can shed some light on some of the more specific questions about the city's finances related to this proposal. I will say I'm here today not to testify on behalf of Senator Torres-Ray's bill, although I believe and although I appreciate and thank so much the senator for her attention to this issue. Yesterday, indeed, the City Council did pass a resolution regarding the future of NRP that involved the TIF districts. It's not in violent opposition to Senator Torres-Ray's bill, but there are some differences in it, and you should have a copy of that resolution in your packet.
Ms. Hodges, we have a resolution, but it doesn't indicate that it was voted on.
That's because it was voted on in the Intergovernmental Relations Committee yesterday. It was unanimous. It stands as the city's official position until the council votes as an entire council on Friday. But it was voted on yesterday, and it is the official position of the city at this moment.
But the city council hasn't actually voted on it as a whole?
No. That will happen on Friday. But it is council policy to take IGR actions that are unanimously approved as the official position of the city.
And how many members of the council are on the subcommittee?
Six. And there was also the Ways and Means Committee met with one additional member who also voted to support this. So technically speaking, there have been seven folks who have supported this.
And is what they considered what we have?
Yes.
Or was it amended?
No, it is exactly what you have in front of you is what passed.
Okay. Thank you.
So the... Last year, there was a bill that came up here at the legislature regarding the future of NRP, and at the time, the commitment the city made was to say we need to have an internal conversation and we need to have a conversation with our residents about the future of NRP, and that last year's bill was getting out somewhat ahead of the residents of Minneapolis. And so to that end, we put together a process, which we've been working on over the course of the past year, to examine not only the future of this program, but our community engagement overall. We've had numerous public meetings with residents of Minneapolis. And for NRP in particular, we put together the internal work group. We created the framework for the future of the program and put that out publicly. We are in the midst of our public engagement process around that. Your deadlines did not coincide with ours, however, and we knew this year the funding portion of the current bill and the funding portion of the future of NRP was going to be something we did need to address in this year's legislature. I will say, and I'll say a little bit later as well, the governance portion, Section 2 of this bill, is something the City Council does oppose because it gets out ahead of the public process we are in the middle of with our residents. And we are currently getting feedback and incorporating feedback from residents on the framework for the future about the governance of whatever happens with NRP after 2009. And we respectfully request that the legislature not take action until after the city residents have had their input considered and the city council has incorporated that and made a decision, which is part of the resolution we passed yesterday, which is in front of you. However, the part that is in common is there is a request for an extension of the TIF district. We are more what you have in front of you does have some specific uses for the dollars. Yes, there is $100 million for NRP. There is also a $100 million request to retire the debt on the Target Center and to meet the capital obligations we by statute are required to meet for the Target Center. This does a couple of things. It supports a statewide facility and asset. It reduces the debt of the city of Minneapolis that we're currently holding on the Target Center, which does have a positive impact on our general fund, on our bottom line, and on our tax levy. And so it was a consideration of the city of Minneapolis moving forward, that were we to extend these districts, we would want it for this dual purpose, as well as some consideration to discretionary dollars for the city and potentially for the county should they choose to participate in the NRP program as well. So that is the proposal that the city has voted on and the city has put forward. And again, it is not entirely different from the bill in front of you, but there are some differences that I wanted to represent that the city holds. And I did just, again, want to say we also had a discussion about the governance. I know today is more about the taxes, but there has been discussion here about the potential governance of an extended NRP program or a new program after 2009 when the city's fiscal obligation sunsets. But again, that governance is being discussed in an open public process with residents and in good faith with them and the folks who have gone to and the neighborhoods who've gone to so much trouble to give us their input about our proposed governance structure. We don't want to move forward ahead of them. So again, Jack Christ is here today. He can speak to some of the more specific questions that you have about city finances related to these TIF districts. And thank you for your time today.
Mr. Christ, I do believe that the work that's being done on the NRP program is pretty good value for the dollar in the city of Minneapolis. Why doesn't the city of Minneapolis just levy for this?
I think part of the answer you heard in the earlier testimony from the folks from NRP, and that is, as you're well aware, there is competition for levy. The program was originally designed, the NRP program was originally designed back in 1989 with a dedicated funding source that was supposed to carry it through its 20-year life. And that funding source was almost exclusively the tax increment that was derived from the common project, that subset of tax increment districts in the city. that is in itself largely comprised of the pre-79 tax increment districts. It had a dedicated funding source. And I think that, one, you have this element of competition for the basic, for levy, which is the source for basic services within the city of Minneapolis. You have some uncertainty about the levy and what limits itself may be imposed on it. It doesn't become a stable or predictable funding source, which is the kind of funding source that's needed for a program of this type. I hope that gets to your point, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two somewhat unrelated points, or question, or one point and one question. One point is probably also important for the committee to recall the 2001 tax bill, which dramatically reduced commercial industrial property taxes, which dramatically reduced the available increment going into NRP. And so NRP was scaled back quite dramatically, I think by a factor of one half. And so, you know, the original vision for NRP is, you know, slowed down and was impacted extensively and dramatically. So that's one point. That's one argument for the extension of the district. So that's the point I was going to make. Question I have to Councilmember Hodges' earlier testimony, perhaps to Mr. Crist, is does the $750,000, this has to do with the Target Center, which under your proposal is part of the use of the extended district resources would go to retiring the debt. The $750,000 that the state appropriates annually for Target Center, does that go to debt service or does that go to operations?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, that currently goes to pay debt service.
So that appropriation would become unnecessary on the state's part. So that would be a benefit to the state.
That is also, of course, under consideration for elimination in 2009. If I may, Mr. Chairman, on those very points, the impact of tax law changes in 2009 can't be ignored in this conversation because it does, in fact, form the basis for an answer to a question that you had posed earlier about what's the connection, why should the tax increment and the consequences thereof be used for extending the districts. The NRP program was originally scheduled to be funded at approximately a total of $400,000, $220,000 in its first 11 years, and then in its last 9 years, which was called Phase 2, another $180,000. The city was obligated under the special law that set up that system to provide $20 million a year of funding, largely from the Common Project and these pre-79 districts, to fund the program. And we were able to, in fact, fund that program through the entirety of its Phase 1 and through 2001. However, it was in 2002 when the city and along with other jurisdictions in the state felt the consequences of the tax law changes in the prior year. That was the first year that there was not sufficient revenues any longer in tax increment to fund the program at the amounts that were inspected. And in fact, through the second half of the program, the original projected amount in the state law has fallen short by $107 million. So there is a connection between looking for $100 million of revenue that would bring the program back to the amount at which it was originally intended to be funded. There was a similar consequence regarding the Target Center. The Target Center debt service, without any change of evaluation in the property, the tax increment that was being used for its debt service payments dropped by almost 40% between 2001 and 2002, which placed an additional burden on the city, who never really wanted to own the Target Center in the first place, but it placed an additional burden on the city to continue the debt service payments, which are in existence until this day.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Just a clarification, maybe Ms. Soff can help me. On page 2, line 12, where this amount allocated under this provision is divided equally between the city's general fund and the neighborhood revitalization program, is this general fund allocation, is that the XL or the target center that they're talking about, or what is that?
Mr. Chairman, I can speak
Mr.
to that
Crist.
A little bit. This is not our work. But the methodology that's being recommended in this bill is that instead of having the city receive tax increment, it is declared excess, and therefore under the current treatment of excess tax increment revenues is apportioned according on a proportional basis related to tax rate to the city, the county, and the school boards. Under that proportioning, the city receives a $10 million amount. I'm sorry, receives a 50% amount of the total. So it depends on the amount.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Crist, I'd like to follow up on some of Senator Dibble's earlier questions related to this. I don't know if you've seen this, if you have a copy of this document.
I was just handed a copy.
Okay. In focusing on the red portion of the pie in the top chart, do those numbers seem accurate to you as it relates to the real effect on Minneapolis, or is that it says loss? And so what I'm trying to figure out is this LGA recalculated, and that's the amount that essentially is distributed in the formula to other communities, or is that without calculating how the $10 million would fare in the formula? And then also the same for the $2 million in fiscal disparities. And maybe this isn't something you'd be able to answer on the fly, but I'm curious how end game these numbers are, or if this is just sort of something that isn't yet put through the formula.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Larson, we had asked Mr. Van Wyken, who does a lot of analytical work on this subject, I believe, for this body as well as the city of Minneapolis, to do a fairly detailed estimate projection of what the effect would be both for the LGA. We frankly didn't know what the outcome would be, and for fiscal disparities. The work that he did, as I say, was fairly detailed because he needed to project to make some assumptions about what the tax growth was going to be in the other affected jurisdictions and statewide, and what the tax rates would be in the various jurisdictions. And this number, this $10 million, is in the range of reasonable possibility based on current LGA formula. And the same is true of the fiscal disparities loss number. If I may say something about the other numbers, which I say that I've just seen, the LGA loss and the fiscal disparities loss seem reasonable based on that work and current LGA formula. They would, in fact, the LGA loss doesn't come into effect until 2011. There's a year's lag from the time of decertification of the districts. But it would be a real amount that would need to be made up somehow by the city to the degree that it affected public services and needed to be levied, basic services and needed to be levied for.
But Mr. Crist, when the property comes online, the LGA just shifts to levy on the property that's the increment. I mean, there's no loss to the city.
There is the point I was making, Senator Bach, was that the city has to make a decision about what it's going to levy for. That was my point. It's not an automatic shift of dollars. In the same respect, the dollars that are shown in black under with decertification would appear to be revenues to the city, but that's not the case. What decertification causes is the creation of additional tax base for the city. And once again, the city and the other jurisdictions listed will have to make their own decisions about how they intend to use that tax base, whether they intend to let it affect the the tax rates or whether or not they need to levy against it.
Thank you. Senator Torres-Ray, anybody else?
I don't have anybody else, Mr. Chairman.
Would anybody else like to feel compelled to testify on the bill?
There's somebody in the audience.
Thank you. My name is Jeffrey Strand. I'm an elected member of the NRP Policy Board and a North Minneapolis resident. I know your time is very stretched today, Mr. Chairman and Senators, but I would just like to endorse the extension of the TIF districts. I would like to provide to your committee clerk a copy of the NRP Policy Board resolution adopted in December that supported full funding and an independent NRP policy board. As you may know, the policy board consists of 19 members, including city council, the mayor, county commissioners, community interest members, and four elected neighborhood representatives, of which I am one. I respect your time today. I do ask you to support this. And particularly with regard to the current mortgage foreclosure crisis that, as Mr. Miller alluded, believe me, if the neighborhood infrastructure in Minneapolis and especially in targeted neighborhoods that are severely impacted, like my neighborhood in North Minneapolis, if we lose that neighborhood infrastructure, the city, the county, the state legislature, I believe you will all pay more. We will all pay more. And so please look very carefully and consider not only the benefits but the possible negative outcomes if you do not support this action. Thank you. May I give that resolution to your committee chair? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strand. Senator Pappas, are you ready? Senator Watts, you're on the committee. Just in case we can't get through our agenda, Senator Pappas, would you like to go next?
Mr. Chairman, that's all I have for this particular bill.
Senator Torres-Ray, thank you. Chair lays over Senate File 3643 for possible consideration in the committee bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Senator Pappas, welcome.
Mr. Chairman and members, I have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, which I would appreciate if someone would offer.
I'd like to move that, Mr. Chair.
In front of us, members, is Senate File 3731. And Senator Pappas, this is the first hearing on the bill?
Yes, it is.
Senator Moy moves the A1 amendment. Counsel, can you tell us what the A1 does?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Senator Pappas's original bill eliminates the detachment for the property at the airport in St. Paul from the city and school district levies. This amendment would instead repeal the entire law that provided for the detachment of both the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport and the St. Paul Airport from the city and school districts.
So it would treat both airports consistently, Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, if you'd like a little background, in 1996, I authored the legislation to detach the St. Paul Holman Field Airport from the city and the school district to create parity between Holman Field and Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport so that we could increase businesses, increase economic development at Holman Field, and not be at a competitive disadvantage because of the differing tax treatment. There is some thought that maybe it's time that all the businesses be treated equally in the city and that we don't give preferential treatment to the businesses at both airports. So I wanted to continue with the same parity. That's what the A1 amendment does.
On the A1 amendment, members, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A1's adopted. Senator Pappas, on your amended bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just to reiterate, in 96, we did offer a tax break to the businesses that would locate, and were located at Home and Field. And they have, over the years, they were required to increase economic development by at least 20%. And for that tax break, they did do that. And they also paid in lieu of taxes to the city of St. Paul, but it was not at all equivalent to what they would be paying if they were taxed. I think the total tax burden for the airport, I just have an estimate from the city, would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $600,000. So the reason we're here today is to say maybe it's time to close this loophole and have the businesses pay their fair share of taxes.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Pappas, just so I can get a feel for what kind of businesses we're talking about, I mean, the only businesses I can think about at Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport are the shops. Are there other businesses that were affected?
Mr. Chairman, I have to say, Senator Skoy, I'm not sure exactly, because I've been focusing more on the Holman Field situation, where we have the aviation and the people who have hangars there. You know, and there are some of those businesses that are probably here to testify.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Pappas, do you have anybody who would like to testify?
I don't know if anyone has signed up or is interested in testifying.
Would anybody like to testify on the bill?
Chair, members, this is really an issue of tax fairness and closing a loophole. What we're talking about here is that...
But could we have your name and who you represent for the record?
Tom Diamond, just public citizen. There are three district councils, the community councils within St. Paul, that have passed resolutions to support this effort. District 1 Community Council, District 4 Dayton's Love Community Council, and WESCO. But this is really an issue of tax fairness is what it is. And also there's the issue of tax revenue. As you know, in many communities, but certainly in St. Paul, whether it be our school district or our city, we are looking for funds everywhere. And we have people who are out doing bake sales to try and support their school programs, to do fundraising for our parks programs. And we have commercial property here that pays absolutely no taxes, no property taxes, to the city or to the school district, or to fiscal disparities, or to the state pool. Roughly what we're talking about that is not paid a year is $100,000 to the city, roughly $100,000 to the school district, $200,000 is not paid to fiscal disparities, and $200,000 is not paid annually to the state general fund. And this is not just the revenue, but as I said, the revenue is important. It's a case of fairness. And I'll point out a couple of examples just to give you a sense. There's an article that was in the Pioneer Press not long ago that talks about one of the large corporations here, that their CEO received $98,000 a year of free travel on their corporate jets, and that the corporation said they were going to put a stop to it. This is free travel for the family for vacations. They now only allow $50,000 of free travel on the corporate jets, on top of the $11.8 million that the individual is paid a year. One of the corporations that uses this airport just not long ago gave a $100,000 cash payment, a bonus, to one of their vice presidents. The corporation who benefits the most from not paying taxes on this is BBA Aviation Incorporated, headquartered on Balderton Street in London, England. That corporation owns Signature, which owns Regent. So by not paying taxes, those benefits are being given to a corporation in London. Again, nothing against any of these corporations, but these corporations are not hardly hardship cases. On the other side of the scale, in St. Paul, whether you take examples of a wonderful neighborhood mom-and-pop operation like Jarbeck's Bakery, you take wonderful operation like the Sweet Hollow Cafe, You take a look at the seniors who are living on fixed incomes. They all pay their property taxes. It is hard to imagine how we can justify that some of the most well-off, the most who have the most benefits, pay absolutely no taxes, and the mom-and-pop operations and the people on fixed income or limited income are paying their property taxes. So from a fairness standpoint, but also from much-needed revenue for the community, I would certainly encourage your making this change. Thank you.
Senator,
thank you, Mr. Chair. To the witness, I didn't catch your name. Were those numbers just for Holman Field?
Those are just for Holman Field.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you make sure you sign in for us so we can get the spelling on your name? Who else would like to testify on the bill?
Greetings. My name is Jerry Berquist. I live at 46 Prospect Boulevard in St. Paul in the same neighborhood of Senator Pappas here. Carlos Garcia Velasco is our lead organizer and executive director for the District 3 Planning Council. And he's going to be providing you with copies of the estimated benefits, tax benefits, to these properties at Holman Field for the year 2007. These numbers are put together by Chris Samuel of the Ramsey County Tax Assessors Organization. The bottom line is that for 2007, $630,000 of tax benefits were accrued by this legislation that the state of Minnesota passed in 1996. Granted, these corporations are paying payments in lieu of taxes, but that amount is only 10% of the total liability. In fact, in 2007, payments in lieu of taxes were $63,278, which is approximately 10% of the total liability here. As Tom Diamond has pointed out, this is an issue about tax fairness.
Mm-hmm.
If we are providing this sort of tax benefits of almost 90% to some of the largest corporations here in the state of Minnesota, why do we not provide the same benefits to Holiday gas station? Why don't we provide the same benefits to any business that you can think of here in the city of St. Paul, Ramsey County, or anywhere else in the state? We believe that especially in times of fiscal problems, we're being starved in the city of St. Paul for funding. Mayor Coleman will be showing up here in a few minutes discussing the issues about how there's issues about funding from the state and other places for the city to provide the benefits that we all expect in the city of St. Paul, the capital city. So with that, I will end and point out that I appreciate if you look at these numbers, and if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berquist.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sundrum.
Mr. Chair, may I ask Senator Pappas, just to be clear, some of the language I read here talked about intermediate airports. Would this apply just to Holman Field, or could it apply to my city in Rochester?
Mr. Chairman, it only applies, Senator Sundrum, to Holman Field. That's the only intermediate airport.
And with the amendment, Senator Pappas?
The amendment applies just to, better ask Ms. Selner. I think it's just MSP.
Correct. Oh, well.
But that was my intention when I asked her to draft it. The amendment makes it just apply to MSP, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, the amendment eliminates the benefit that was available to MSP in the first paragraph and to St. Paul only in the second.
Doesn't affect any other airport.
Right.
Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Clint Coomer. I am the general manager of Signature Flight Support at the St. Paul Downtown Airport. Our company coordinates and provides various ground support services to business and general aviation aircraft, as well as medical and emergency service aircraft that are based in St. Paul or may fly in from around the country. I'm here today on behalf of the tenants at the St. Paul Downtown Airport to voice our concern over the bill that Senator Pappas has introduced, changing the tax status for businesses at our airport. As you know, Senator Pappas and Representative Mariani originally authored the bill that provided Holman Field these exemptions back in 1996. At the time, in 1996, the St. Paul Airport was underutilized and struggling. It was imperative to make the airport an economically viable enterprise that would create jobs, promote growth in the community, and relieve some of the congestion problems that face the international airport. The intent of the tax relief was also to level the playing field with the international airport, as they were already detached from city and school district taxes, which created an unfair advantage for them when trying to attract new business. Now, in exchange for the exemption, the tenants at St. Paul agreed to make annual payments to the city for police and fire protection, increase the total market value of the airport property by at least 20% within 5 years, and work with local students to provide mentoring and promote careers in aviation. 12 years later, the 1996 legislation has been and continues to be an absolute resounding success. Currently, there are over 300 people employed at the airport, many from the surrounding community. The local area has enjoyed a substantial impact on business activities, including car rentals, local restaurants, and hotels that have benefited. It's estimated that the economic benefit of the airport to the surrounding community has grown to over $112 million a year annually. In regards to the total market value of the airport property, we experienced a 200% increase in value as of 2001, and to date, a total increase of over $21 million in value since 1996. This far exceeds the original objective of the agreement. The St. Paul tenants have also clearly met the commitment to promote education and mentoring. Signature has an employee that spends a significant amount of her work time devoted to this mission. She's formed a partnership with Farnsworth Aerospace, which is an aviation-focused elementary school in St. Paul's east side. We provide tours, donate money, books, and pilot supplies. And this school has been so successful that they're currently making plans to expand their program. On a more personal level, I've been involved with an organization called ACE Camp for several years. This is a joint venture with the FAA, the Department of Transportation, and several local aviation companies that provide week-long summer camps for high school students who introduce them to various aviation-related careers. We've worked with St. Paul Connections and the public schools locally to ensure economically disadvantaged students are allowed the opportunity to participate at a reduced rate, or in many cases free of charge due to the donations made by our local companies. As you can plainly see from these few examples, the tax relief provided in 1996 has truly been a win-win for the airport tenants and the community. The current bill introduced that will change the tax status is of great concern to the tenants. As you know, the recent economic downturn has severely impacted the aviation industry as a whole. These conditions and soaring fuel prices combined with the additional taxes and the competitive advantage Minneapolis will again enjoy will endanger the prosperity and future of our businesses at the airport. In recent years, our tenants have made considerable capital investments at Holdman Field. We survived 176 days and millions in lost revenue due to floods. We've struggled through the effects of 9/11 and the resulting effects on our industry. And now we're fighting to achieve success at a very difficult economic climate. Now, some people have characterized the current tax exemption as a loophole. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the businesses at the St. Paul Downtown Airport strongly disagree. We feel that current tax policy is necessary for the survival of our airport and has clearly been mutually beneficial for the city, airport, and surrounding communities. Thank you for your time.
Very good.
Mr. Chair.
Please state your name for the record.
Bruce Haggerty, Hubbard Broadcasting, local broadcasting company and general aviation tenant at St. Paul Downtown Airport. Hubbard Broadcasting has been a general aviation tenant at St. Paul Downtown Airport for over 35 years. We have had an opportunity to build two private aviation hangars at St. Paul Downtown Airport, first in 1988 and second in 2000. We have made significant investment at St. Paul Downtown Airport. We've worked with the Metropolitan Airports Commission over the years in making that happen. I certainly think anyone familiar with St. Paul Downtown Airport will suggest that there have been significant improvements in the nature of the capital investments there in the last 20 years. To the suggestion that general aviation or other commercial operations at St. Paul Downtown Airport are not making contributions to the city, the state, I would take just a moment to share with the senators the kinds of contributions that a entity such as Hubbard Broadcasting makes in order to operate a hangar at St. Paul Downtown Airport. First of all, Hubbard Broadcasting, specifically operating down there as HC Incorporated, is paying annual assessments of approximately $32,000. The purpose of these assessments are to pay back the Metropolitan Airports Commission for infrastructure investment at the time that they opened up the southwesterly portion of the hangar for development. The Metropolitan Airports Commission is being paid back all of the monies that were invested for ramps and taxiways, and that's being paid by the tenants. Additionally, we need to remember that the investments for hangar space at St. Paul Downtown Airport are made on Metropolitan Airports Commission property. Each tenant pays a ground lease fee to the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Hubbard Broadcasting pays approximately $75,000 annually to the Metropolitan Airports Commission on that ground lease. Additionally, Hubbard Broadcasting, as all other general aviation operations utilizing Jet A fuels at St. Paul Downtown Airport, pay landing fees. And that's on a per-use basis. We pay something on the order of $5,000 to $6,000 annually just for the purpose of landing fees. Hubbard Broadcasting, along with the other commercial operators at St. Paul Downtown Airport, has agreed to pay the City of St. Paul for police and fire protection services. I think that was earlier referenced. Hubbard Broadcasting's share of that cost is approximately $3,500 a year. Additionally, and it should be noted for the record, that Ramsey County taxes are payable on the site, and Hubbard's contribution of Ramsey County taxes is approximately $13,000 annually. In a variety of those different MAC fees, landing fees, fuel tipping fees, we make contributions to the MAC, the City of St. Paul, and Ramsey County in an amount of $135,000 annually. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, sir, I don't doubt that Hubbard and the other companies there are contributing to the communities. I just think that every other business in St. Paul is also contributing, and they're paying at a higher tax rate. I understand why you'd rather not pay more in taxes, but it's either you pay more in taxes or they pay more in taxes. If you pay less, they pay more. That's the issue I'm wondering about.
Mr. Hagerty.
Good point, Senator. I will just draw your attention, if you will, and I don't know what materials have been put in front of you. I'm party to some documents from the 1995-1966 time period when this initial legislation took place, at a point in time when both the City Council of St. Paul, St. Paul Public Schools, St. Paul Chamber of Commerce, and the St. Paul Port Authority were all strong proponents of this enabling legislation. And the fiscal policy director for the City of St. Paul at that point in time, Mr. Greg Blease, suggested that the difference, if you will, in tax contribution brought about by this particular legislation would amount to a tax increase to the other property tax-paying entities of 0.87%. At that point in time, his indication was that a St. Paul homestead with an estimated market value of that time of $75,000 was currently paying $1,185 in property taxes. The impact of this legislation on that particular home at that time was $1.03 annually.
Thank you, Mr. Hagerty. Nonetheless, it is a tax shift. I think Senator Marty's right that it's any time we shift property or exempt someone from property taxes, it's a tax increase on every other taxable property. Are there any? I think the Metropolitan Airports Commission is also asked to testify. I don't know if they're still desiring to do that. Mr. Killian is here. Mr. Killian, please state your name for the record.
Mitch Killian with the Metropolitan Airports Commission, Director of Governmental Affairs. Just a couple of comments. There was a question about who this all affects, and it's the first time that I've seen the amendment that includes Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, but my quick read of it is that it would affect all the tenants at MSP, and that would go from Royal, Zeno, the shoeshine guy, to Sun Country, Champion Air, Northwest Airlines, of course, but the tenants throughout the whole MSP airport would have would be reattached to the school district and city portion of the property taxes.
Well, Mr. Killian, I don't think that I'd have to get clarification, but I don't believe that the Metropolitan Airports or the Minneapolis-St. Paul International is within a school district or within a city property. I think that the only jurisdiction is the county property. Or the county district, and we could get clarification from council, but I don't believe that there's a city or a school district effect.
Council, do we know?
Mr. Chairman, we don't know yet, but we've got people checking on that to see where this would fit. In St. Paul, it's clear that property is within the city of St. Paul and the school district, but it's not clear right now as to whether or not the property at MSP is currently within a school district or a particular municipality.
Okay. Chairman and members, that's exactly where I was going, and part of the issue that I wanted to raise is that question of which school district and things. If the intent is to do the same thing that the original bill was, which is to reattach it to a school district and the city portion of the property taxes, the question is which city and school district. But also there's a broader question here of at MSP, they're truly detached in the sense of we have our own police department, our own fire department, and you have to be careful about the language. If this is reattaching, is this going to mean that the Minneapolis Police Department, or is it the Bloomington Police Department, or is it the Richfield Police Department, and which school district? So eventually, if this were to move forward, need to be careful and make sure that there's some clarification about what reattachment means. Second piece is, the point that I wanted to make is, the Airports Commission has worked very hard over the years to keep costs very low. It's a continuous discussion as we approach new tenants, whether it be air carriers or tenants for our reliever airport systems. Oftentimes, the term landing fee comes up. The real term that we use is cost per enplaned passenger for airline services. It's the accumulative cost to the airlines, not just the landing fee, but the rents, the fuel flow fees, tax structures that are in place that the airlines look at. And this number comes up very often. In fact, less than 2 weeks ago, we were out talking to Southwest Airlines. Southwest Airlines looks at the market, the demographics, and other factors of the community, but every time the discussion turns towards what are your costs on your airports? What's the overall cost? Another example I can give you is there's a new startup carrier called Allegiant Air. They hosted an event not too long ago that they invited airport managers from St. Cloud, Madison, MSP out to talk to them. They look at markets. They think there's a lot of markets that they want to serve out there, but a lot of their decision is based on the overall cost of operation of the facilities and what's going on at that airport. We've been able to keep, for a northern tier airport, our costs very comparatively low. We're in the lower 50 percentile of hubs our size. We think that that's very important as we continue to seek new air service or continue the air service we have. We constantly monitor Detroit. We want to know exactly what Detroit's cost per enplaned passengers are versus ours, and this would add an additional cost at our airport. That's all I had, Mr. Chairman, unless there's any questions for me.
Thank you. Anything else from the committee? Would anybody else like to testify? Very briefly, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'll be brief. My name is Carlos Garcia Velasco. I'm the lead organizer at Westside Citizens Organization, Planning District Council 3 in the city of St. Paul. Attachment was unanimously supported by our board of directors, which is made up of retired folks, renters, past veterans, small business owners, and I believe that you all understand that this is about shifting the tax burden and about equity. I was at a meeting last night at Humboldt High School where we are engaging with the larger, with the community and the school to try to address the challenge of disparities in funding and of trying to keep a focus for the school so that it can continue to exist. And when the question that we started out with was, what are the benefits to our community by our neighbors at the downtown airport? And in trying to do some research around this, we discovered that this tax, quote-unquote, loophole existed. So, again, this is about equity, and I just wanted to testify for the record that our board fully supported it. It's made up of about 20 volunteers in the West Side community, and so we think it's time that the burden of the taxes are shared and that this disparity is closed. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Pappas, anything further?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, well, it's clear that there was a need for a kind of an economic development bump at Holman Field 12 years ago, and so now it's really up to the committee and the legislature to decide, is it time to phase out that tax benefit? Is it appropriate for us to promote a broad tax policy where everyone pays their fair share? Or is it appropriate for us to continue to rely on kind of side arrangements, reliance on donations, and individual businesses or employee generosity, which there has been significant from Holman Field? Of course, as Senator Marty mentioned, there are plenty of businesses who do pay their taxes and also donate to community projects. So, Mr. Chairman, I would appreciate the committee's support.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And given the Senator Pappas, given the amendment that went on, I think if it's possible either for the MAC or somebody to provide information similar to this as to what how this would impact MSP would be helpful to the committee for us to know, because I think that there are some additional exemptions that are in place at MSP that aren't in place at other airports. And so I think it'd be interesting for us to have that list as well.
We will try and generate that. Chair lays over Senate file 3731 as amended for possible inclusion in the committee bill. Thank you, Senator Pappas. Senator Moore. Today's our last day.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for giving me the time to present to you Senate File 3773. I have the mayor of the city of St. Paul and the deputy mayor here who will speak in more detail. But let me just start by saying this. You know, Senate File 3773 is very simple, Mr. Chair, members. We have a downtown 7th place TIF district, which is a pre-79 district, that is set to decertify July of this year. And what Senate File 3773 does is that we're asking for an extension of that TIF district until 2030. Now, Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy and Senator Marty and members of the committee, as a member of this committee, I have always not been the most enthusiastic supporter of efforts to extend TIF districts. And so it is not with a lot of enthusiasm that I come forward to ask this committee to extend a TIF district in the city of St. Paul. But this committee, more than anybody here at the legislature, Mr. Chair, knows that we are operating in extraordinary times. And the city of St. Paul is it's experiencing tremendous, tremendous distress at this time. And so it is because of the nature of how extraordinary these circumstances are that I am coming forward to ask you to help me extend this TIF district. And I ask you to take into consideration the information that will be given to you by the mayor and the deputy mayor, and I hope that you will support me in this effort.
Mr. Mayor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's nice to be here this morning. I'm also joined, in addition to Deputy Mayor Ann Mulholland, we have Council President Kathy Lantry is present, Harry Melander, St. Paul Building Trades, Chris Johnson, St. Paul Chamber of Commerce. We have other members of the labor community that are present and supportive of this this bill. We also have in the packet before you resolutions from the St. Paul City Council in support of this, the Ramsey County Board. There's a letter of support from the Chamber and the building trades, and there's also, I believe, a letter of support from the St. Paul School District that has indicated that they are supportive of this measure as well. As you know, the event district in the city of St. Paul is a district that really does have a statewide impact. It is home to high school hockey tournaments. It's home to great destinations for families, the Children's Museum, the Science Museum. It is a place where we hopefully will see a run of the Minnesota Wild well into the playoff season this year. Apparently, it's also a place where guys from New Jersey can come and rock out still, which brings a lot of people to our downtown area. As a matter of fact, we have about 4.5 million people that come into this area every year to participate at some event, whether it's at the Ordway, the Science Museum, Xcel Energy Center, River Center, et cetera. The event district generates about $200 million a year in terms of economic impact. When we have conventions, each convention delegate or attendee spends on average about $318 a day on meals, lodging, entertainment, and et cetera. The whole event district, which is concentrated in just a few blocks, really constitutes a lot of investment on a lot of people's parts. The city of St. Paul, private investment. It is public investment, philanthropic investment. The state of Minnesota has played a role in that as well. But the fact of the matter is, though this event district is critically important for the city of St. Paul, it is stressed at this time. The way that the original financing for the River Center was set up has not allowed us to continue to invest in some basic capital improvements and basic needs of the facility. Our ability to extend and enhance the district through redevelopment of the Cleveland Circle site is impaired because of lack of resources. We have tried different ways that we could go about trying to bring additional resources into the district. We certainly understand the state's situation and the financial strain that the state of Minnesota has. If you look at even on the bonding bill, the need to at least maybe bring that down a little bit in terms of what we had previously thought we'd be able to get in the bonding bill. And so we have taken the approach that we would come to the state and ask you to allow us to help ourselves by the extension of the TIF district. If we can extend the tax increment financing district, we can reinvest in this this area. We can continue to help it grow. We can do the basic things that are necessary to do to continue to make to strengthen this district and really have it be the cultural and regional asset that it is. You know, if you have been anywhere near there this last month, you've seen families from across the state of Minnesota. If you're there during the fall, you'll see great cultural events. You have, you know, the Festival of Nations that takes place down there. You have Hmong New Year. You have events of all shapes and sizes that really draw people in from all over. And it isn't just one facility. It really is a district because there are just so many different pieces to it that all play off of each other. It is really kind of a great partnership that allows us to do to be as strong as we are. But again, we're at a point where we a critical juncture where we need to reinvest in this district. And absent that, the ability to be as strong as we are and to continue to strengthen that relationship will be impaired. And so, understanding the situation of the state, understanding the need for the city of St. Paul to look at alternative ways. We believe that this is a way that the state can allow the city of St. Paul to help itself to get this district the resources that it needs to improve it. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Ann Mulholland to go through some of the details of the district. Mr. Smith got some crazy notion that he was entitled to a vacation. He's not present with us today, but a lot of Mr. Smith's work and his knowledge is into this proposal.
Mr. Mayor, how many years of debt service are left on the River Center?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the debt goes to 2025.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Moi, I really appreciate your qualifying statements when you made those remarks. I have to ask you, though, do you have a house companion for this?
I believe we have a house companion for it. In fact, I think that my house member, Representative Mahoney, is the one who's carrying it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Ma. I'm looking at the revenue sheet, and there's not one listed. That's why I asked.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I believe it's just been put in this week.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Moi. How much annually are we talking about in terms of benefit?
Mr. Chair and Senator Larson, we're looking at $6.4 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Moi, what do you know what the impact is to the fiscal disparities pool if the TIF district decertified and the properties came online? What annual payment?
Ms. Mulholland may have that answer for you, Senator Larson.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Why don't you give us your name and who you represent for the record?
Yes, Ann Mulholland. I'm Deputy Mayor for the City of St. Paul. We have not fully analyzed the impact on fiscal disparity because our approach has been this, in that we are asking for an extension of an existing TIF district. And currently, the TIF district isn't paying into the fiscal disparity pool, so we're viewing this as a status quo extension.
But Ms. Mulholland, under current law, it will. TIF is decertified under current law, it
Correct.
Will be a contributor.
Correct.
Yeah. So I do think, Senator Larson, that's a good point. Yes. We need to know what that is, because that cost does shift onto all the other CI property in the metro area.
Mr. Chair, I apologize.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think also, I mean, we had the discussion earlier on Senator Torres Ray's bill, and also what the impact is on the LGA formula, and with all these TIF districts decertifying, there's a statewide impact that's smaller, but certainly a metro-wide impact with any of the decertifications. And I know they're happening all across the state. They're not just here. I think we're only hearing about, I think, what amounts to about half of what are decertifying.
Mr. Chair and Senator Larson, I think that's one of the reasons why we are looking at alternative ways that we can continue to invest in this district is because of the loss of local government aid in the city of St. Paul, which is approximately $20 million a year right now, and cumulatively well in excess of $100 million since 2003. The fact of the matter is the resources that might otherwise have been available to do some things like this, to reinvest in the district, are not available. And so it's one of the challenges that not only the city of St. Paul, but I suspect cities across the state of Minnesota are facing.
Mr. Chair and Senator Larson, we will try to get those numbers, and I will provide them to the committee.
Thank you. Ms. Mulholland, anything more to add?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senators, the one thing I wanted to add is there are two key issues here. The challenge with the River Center is an important one, and that is that the financing model back in 1993, the city kind of won it alone to build the River Center, and therefore their operating dollars for the River Center are going to pay down debt. It's a model that is extraordinarily challenging and has really taken a huge turn for the worse in the more recent years in the convention business. We need to reverse that challenge in a meaningful way, and we need to do it quickly. I guess, secondly, as we're moving forward in terms of how the City of St. Paul intends to work with its partners in using the resources made available by extending this district, three very key things are where we're going to put our resources. First and foremost, to turn around the operating situation at the River Center so that it's putting operating dollars into operating, which is what it's intended to do. Secondly, that we're reinvesting in a meaningful way in capital reinvestment within the facility itself and around the facility and improvements. And then thirdly, a major redevelopment project within the event district as a whole. Those are the three areas where we intend to use the resources, and we think it's an exciting opportunity for St. Paul, the region, and the state of Minnesota.
Hey, Ms. Mulholland, what is the annual debt service on the River Center? How many dollars?
Mr. Chair, I would have to ask our finance folks sitting behind me. Is that appropriate?
Sure.
$4.5 million. Thank you.
Annually. And what was, in 1993, when the construction was contemplated, what was the city's plan to pay the debt service?
Mr. Chair, Senators, the city has been using a portion of the half-cent sales tax along with operating revenue was part of the plan. Unfortunately, that plan has been is no longer appropriate given the convention industry.
And the city has a 0.5%? What's the city's
Correct.
And what does that generate annually?
The 40% of the 0.5% sales tax, Mr. Chair, generates $6.25 million.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Mayor Coleman, or Ms. Mulholland, if the reason I have real trouble with TIF because I think it's sort of hiding things, if you were able to, supposing the TIF district expired, you'd be collecting maybe $1 million, $1.5 million more a year in property taxes from there. If we gave the city the authority to take in effect the $4 million or so that out of this $6.4 million that presumably is going to this school district in the county, and gave you authority to do it, would the city be making, is there a reason the city couldn't, if we let you get the same amount of money either way, where you would be able to vote on saying every year we want to put $6.4 million into this project? Because that would be much more, the advantage of TIF to the city is you get to take the school and county and smaller things like fiscal disparities and spend that. But if we allowed you to, in effect, take the school district money and do it yourselves, would you and the council be voting for $6.4 million for this? The reason I ask is I picture it be actually you'd probably appropriate less than this if it was up front that you had to say we want to spend $6.4 million of taxpayer money on this. Do you get what I'm trying to get at?
Not, Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, not exactly. I think the challenge is first of all being able to actually capture if this were to go back online, there would have to, you in order to just capture the increment that is taken off, you'd have to actually increase the levy by some whatever the equivalent portion is, which is problematic. Even if you know the effects of it are distributed across the district, one of the
but
reasons
Mr. Mayor,
why
when you increase the levy, it doesn't necessarily raise people's property taxes if you have new capacity coming on.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think the challenge is that, as you know, with the complexities of the tax system, it's hard to predict accurately where the impacts will be. And we saw that this last year with the increase in the property taxes, where there was disproportionate impact on certain properties, certainly on commercial and industrial properties, there's an increase, but on some of the homeowners, especially those that are subject to the limited market value phase-out, you'll see a significant and a disproportionate increase in that. So it is true that the burden, in theory, is shared, but some pain is felt by others more than other homeowners.
But Mr. Chairman, Mayor Coleman, the issue would be that if you take off the TIF, in effect, $6.4 million is coming into, instead of going in the TIF district, it's going to the city, it's going to the county, it's going to the school district, it's going to fiscal disparities, a few other places. But if we gave you the authority to, in effect, take the money from them outside of TIF and actually had this as part of your budget, then every year you would appropriate $6.4 million to this. My question is, because that's, in effect, it's money that's coming from the school and the county. If you had control over that money, if we let the city do that, do you think that the city council and you would be supporting the full $6.4 million, or would you say, well, maybe we'd only be putting $5 million into that? Because it would require the city council and you to say, we're going to take $5 million from other things and put it into here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, first I would say that, again, unless we levy it back, unless all the jurisdictions levied back their equivalent portion of it, in this case it would be the county and the city, that money is not available as excess, so whatever money you would take. But in addition to that, the answer to the question of would we use this equivalent amount of money, this was 6.4, the answer would be yes, because of the needs of the facilities to expand them, to do some of the capital needs, and to do the development on the Cleveland Circle site. We believe, we don't have exact numbers and we're in the process of putting those together, but we do think that the number would be right around that $6.4 million, and quite frankly, the needs of the district would exceed that where there are funds available.
Willen, did you have some debt?
Mr. Chairman, just one final comment, and that is that I think that I realize there's a lot of need here. I have a feeling that when you're dealing with the rest of the city budget, you feel there's a lot of need there too, and the school district I know is asking for more, and the counties are pretty desperate too. The trouble with TIF is it artificially pulls, because you wouldn't need to levy more. You would automatically, you're already levying that much, it's just being pulled aside into TIF, and in effect, if you stopped pulling it aside for TIF, it would be going to the county, the school, and the city anyhow.
Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, I think, and we may be kind of quibbling over it or different terminology, but if we in the city of St. Paul have a levy of $70 million and this money were to come off, the levy would still be $70 million unless we were to increase it by $6.5 million. Okay. It's just who pays for it and how that gets distributed. So you would have to, in order to capture this, you would have to increase your levy by an equivalent $6.4 million in order to be able to do that, and which is just to make up, you're talking about a 7.5% to 8% increase in your levy. Let's move on.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senators, the one thing I'd like to add to that in terms of getting at the $6.4 million, Senator, is the Event District and the City of St. Paul's economic development needs far surpass the $6.4 million. Our economic engine for our city, and I think that helps the region and the state of Minnesota, really is in that Event District. It generates 4.5 million people a year going through that district. We believe with the new development at Cleveland Circle and by improving the model within the River Center and doing the upgrades like pedestrian access, better connecting the Ordway and the Science Museum, we can increase that impact by a substantial amount. It is what we put as a very, very high economic development priority for the city of St. Paul. And this $6.4 million brings us a long way in getting there, but certainly not all the way. And we are using other economic development tools as well to get at that. The city of St. Paul has invested in parks around this facility. The Ramsey County is investing in the Landmark Center. We are working with our partners. You as a state have played a meaningful role in this event district, and we want to do our part in moving that district forward.
Anything else?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I did start my presentation with a caveat, and I know I've sat in this committee and I've watched the TIF extension bills that have come before us this legislative session, and I know that these are extraordinarily difficult times, not just for the city of St. Paul, but for many, many cities all across this state. And if it was within our power as a legislature to do something about that by living up to our obligation in terms of our state and local government partnership, I think that we wouldn't have these local governments coming forward to tax themselves or to solve their own problems. And so I ask for your support in this bill, and it isn't that we're coming here alone. We have the support of the school board, the Ramsey County Board, the St. Paul Chamber of Commerce, the building trades. We have all the parties involved because they, too, all recognize how extraordinary these times are and how much the city of St. Paul needs this. So thank you very much.
Sir, I think that we need to do some work on this. I think the TIF extensions that the committee has seen this year, I don't believe we've extended any pre-79 districts. And I think the extensions we have done have been like some are 4 years, some are 5 years, but certainly none are 30 years. So I think I'm very sympathetic to the situation that the city finds themselves in. And we got a few days, I think, to put our noses to the wheel and try to figure something out that doesn't set just an incredible precedent. So I appreciate it if we could keep working on that. Senator Scoy.
And Mr. Chair, to that point, I think we need to think through as the committee how this impacts the different jurisdictions that the mayor has been talking about, because as you put this back on the levy and the tax rate for CI is 2.0, tax rate for homeowners is 1.0, this is going to interact differently between the commercial and the homeowner. So we need to kind of understand that also as we're thinking about this.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to add to Senator Moy's comments. She mentioned the support of the other jurisdictions. I'm guessing they articulate that this is revenue neutral, I think, because we have some state offset. But for projects like this, similar to the Minneapolis Convention Center, it's very easy, and this is also to Senator Marty, it's very, very easy to show that the benefit to the state is much greater than the effort as a result of attracting the business to the convention centers. All those folks go out and participate in retail activities that generate sales tax, most of which goes to the state. And I think that's why the rationale was good to retire the first phase convention center debt for Minneapolis, so that we could have the privilege of taking on a whole lot new debt for the expansion of the Minneapolis Convention Center. The benefit to the state was huge from retiring that first phase debt, and the city is content with carrying the second phase debt. and is on schedule to retire that. But a successful river center, like I said earlier, has a huge benefit to the state, which more than makes up for the offset, I think, to the schools, and has that general economic benefit.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your time, and I look forward to continuing to work with you on this effort.
Mayor, when's Mr. Smith going to be back?
he will be back Monday.
We'd like his help Monday and Tuesday.
We will make him available.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for coming. Chair lays over Senate File 3773 for possible inclusion.
Are we under call?
I don't know.
Upstairs? Are we under call? Oh, okay.
So, just say we're working on it. I think we've told everybody to get it done by next week. There's nothing really.
Members, we're gonna pull Senator Larson's bill 3207 off for today. So if anybody's here on that, we're gonna hold that over. I think both sides are working on some compromise language there that hopefully we'll have to present to the committee next week. So the last bill today is Senator Langseth, Senate File 3722. Senator Langseth?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this deals with the aggregate tax or gravel tax. To give you a little bit of history of this, I think it was my home county, Clay County, that first came up with this. The situation they had was that it was the eastern part of the county that the gravel was coming out of. Fargo, North Dakota is the largest city in North Dakota, and most of this gravel was going across county and township roads for about 25, 30 miles, raising havoc with the roads. And the benefit was really mainly to the state of North Dakota and to Fargo. So they came to the legislature and got this tax on, and since then, many other counties are involved in it as well. But as I say, many of the provisions of this bill were in the bill last year. I'll have Fred Corrigan explain what is in the bill.
Thank you, Senator Langseth. Mr. Chair, my name is Fred Corrigan. I'm Executive Director of the Aggregate Ready Mix Association of Minnesota. As Senator Langseth mentioned, this bill has been before this committee for the last 3 years, and is the property tax portion of the bill is the same that you have seen in the past, with a small change in the county termination language that we did in response to a suggestion by the Dakota County Assessor's Office. The major change in the bill is Section 3, which is a change in the production tax, an increase in that tax, and a change in the distribution to that tax. This is in response to two things. One, a tax task force report that came to the legislature in 2000 that suggested changes to the formula in the distribution that would allow more funds to go to the host communities, the cities or townships that were hosting this. And so we've changed in this legislation that distribution from 60% to the counties and 30% to the host community to what was suggested in 2000 of 42.5%, 42.5%. And have also changed the distribution to the Special Reserve Fund for Environmental Correction from 10% to 15%. Mr. Chair, those are the major changes to the bill is Section 3. And as I said, Section 1 and 2 is essentially the language that this committee has passed in the past 3 years.
To a large extent, this really is a user fee. It pays for the roads that they deplete as they're hauling the gravel.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just a quick question for Mr. Corrigan about the prohibition on the imposition of additional host community fees from those that benefit from the production tax. Has that been found to be a problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, this, as you may remember, there was a proposal for host community fees a year or two ago, and in our discussions with local government over the last couple of years, we felt it made more sense to try to accomplish the revenue needs that they had within the current tax structure, and we think we've done that, and so we would like to see that prohibited in a county which is currently collecting the aggregate tax.
I see Mr. Matthews nodding, so okay, that's great.
Thank you.
Anything else? Mr. Corrigan, thank you. Does anybody else want to testify on the bill? If not, Chair lays over Senate File 3722 for possible inclusion in the committee bill. Members, that concludes our agenda for today, and everybody should have gotten a notice that this was the last day we were going to hear local bills. So the next time we're going to meet is Wednesday, and our hope is to have the committee bill put together for everybody to see, and then we may have a bill or two. We'll have some additional time that day if we need to take up. And then Thursday our hope is to mark up the committee bill and send it up to the floor. So until Wednesday. Committee's adjourned. Summertime.